Got my coffee.
I'm already a few coffees deep, so we'll be fine. So, we're here with Rhonda Dearsley.
Yeah.
Is, I suppose, the first thing, the intro. And Rhonda, you, what's your position with EBIS?
Okay, so technically my title is Business Development. But what that means basically is I do all of the outbound. So all of the outbound sales, looking for new clients, looking for new customers, that kind of thing. But I also do a lot of relationship management of a lot of our bigger accounts and events and that kind of thing as well. So yeah, business development is my title. My job is far and wide.
Yeah, all encompassing.
Yeah. Lots of hats.
Yeah. So how would you describe EBIS to anyone that's not heard from EBIS or of EBIS before?
Okay, so I mean, basically we are a shipping company. At our fundamental core, that's what we do. We move things for people who need them moved. And we have three main divisions within that kind of structure. We've got a general freight side that does the big volume widgets, aircraft parts, you know, whatever people need shipped from one part of the world to another, we do that. We have an events and exhibitions division, which focuses on supporting specific clients attending events and exhibitions and that kind of thing. And then we have the art side, which is a completely different set of kind of requirements and skills. But again, is basically moving art and crafts and antiques and objet, whatever it happens to be, for anybody from one place to another in a variety of different ways. So that's kind of what we do.
So you've got a whole division of the company subdivided off just to handle arts, crafts, makers, antiques.
Yeah, and you see, we've got a completely separate warehouse for that as well.
Oh, really? So it's fully both physically and in a sort of spreadsheet divided off. Wow. So how does it differ? How does that side of the business differ from, like, because there's loads of people that ship across the world, loads of them.
Yeah.
You know, you've got your big name Parcel Forces and all that stuff, but makers are often very cautious of using people like that because X, Y, and Z stuff gets damaged. So how does the art side differ from the other sides of your business or from other shippers?
Okay, so art for us, the way we handle and the way we look at art and the way we deal with the artists and the makers is very different from the way we deal with freight clients. Because freight clients, you know, it's like, it's business, you know, it's not personal to them. They're not invested in what they've made or what they need shipping from one place to another. For artists and makers, it's very different. There is personal investment. And we, the people that work on our art team within our art division, understand that it's personal. It is, you know, it's something they've put time and effort and love and care and creativity and inspiration and what have you into. And we feel that we should kind of honour that. And, you know, be as respectful and take proper responsibility for something that is precious to somebody else and that's precious to somebody that's bought it as well. You know, not precious necessarily in terms of value, but certainly in terms of, you know, effort that's put into it. So it's just it's an intellectual difference, really, rather than a physical difference. At the end of the day, it's still moving X from A to B. It's just packed in a different way. It's taken care of in a different way, but it's still moved. And, you know, we use courier services as well as everybody else uses courier services like DHL and FedEx and UPS and what have you. We use freight services because the world, you know, we don't have our own airplanes. We don't have our own trains, that kind of thing, you know, so we have to use other people to do those freight shipments with. But it's all about the care with which it's handled and packed and crated, that makes it easy to use those other services that people wouldn't necessarily think would be great for art shipping in the belly of an aircraft.
Yeah,
yeah, that yeah, quite. Great.
Does that answer that question?
Yeah, absolutely. And I want to get more into all that as we get deeper into the podcast, but I really want to, for the listeners, lay out the foundation of Ebis from a sort of high level first. Because if I'm right in thinking, you're a reasonably new company. 2014, am I right?
Yeah, 2014 we started as Ebis, but our managing director, Wayne Forster, has, you know, he's not like me telling you how old he is, but he's been in the business for maybe 30 years. And yeah, he's worked for other companies. He's run his own companies before, but Ebis as a unit, has been in business since 2014. But within that, we have a lot of experience, logistics experience, and also, you know, other kinds of experience. I mean, my background is, for example, it's not logistics. It's events and exhibitions, kind of like running things from the other side. Other people that work with us have very specific kind of like art installation, art hanging, making experience kind of thing. So we are a variety of skills pulled together to make a cohesive unit, which we think works really well because we can see things from different perspectives. We're not just focused on the shipping, which is important. The detail of how to do it is important, but the other stuff's important as well.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because it's not like if you're setting out to hire people within your company, within a shipping company, you may not necessarily gravitate towards people with an art hanging or an art background, yeah, or an events background, but actually for what Ebis is trying to achieve, that's exactly the people you need.
Exactly. And it's it kind of goes back to Jason, who's head of our freight division and looks after all our transportation, things like that. We have this conversation about skills. You know, there are some skills that are really easy to teach, if people are open to learning, and there are other skills that are really difficult to teach. So what you are always looking for, what we are always looking for, is people that have already that kind of that interest in this, specifically on the art side, people already that have an interest on it, that have experience of it, that have, you know, that kind of empathetic inclination, that are drawn towards art, crafts, makers, that kind of thing, that know how important it is to the people that are in that industry, that are artists themselves. Because we can teach the other stuff. We can teach shipping. We can teach how to fill in paperwork. We can teach, you know, who you go to get the best prices for X, Y, or Z. But you can't teach that interest in it. And that's on the art side, that's what's really important. People who have that kind of inclination. And then we teach them
what. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? Yeah, you can certainly teach. You know, similar to when we're looking for, in my side of the business, when we're looking for engineers, you know, I look for people that have done design degrees, because you can teach the engineering side, you can't teach the creativity side.
Exactly.
And you find the same when we are talking to makers. Like, there's a certain mindset you need to have when you're working with makers and crafts, etc., etc., that I'm sure you'll find in your warehouse, that if people just don't have that mindset, they're not going to take the care. No matter how well you train them, they're not going to have that innate care in them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it's really important, because, I mean, we handle a lot of kind of like really high-end stuff, really expensive stuff, but we also handle a lot of, you know, entry level in terms of pricing, ceramics particularly, and artwork and stuff like that. Emerging artists, new artists, people just trying to make their name, get into it kind of thing. And you have to treat it all the same. You have to, philosophically, you have to think of it all the same. And those are the kind of people that we want within our organisation. And I think we pretty much got them. We've got a really, really good art team. we're really happy with things at the moment.
So answer me this, because it'll be the question on everyone's mind that's ever dealt with a courier company or a shipper ever. If something goes wrong or if you need to get a hold of someone, can you pick up the phone to somebody at Ebus? Can you speak to a real life human being?
Yeah, we are very much real life people. Hours as well, because you know, you ship stuff all over the world. Not everybody's on our time zone, unfortunately. So if somebody's going to Korea and there's a problem with it, you might get a phone call at like 5 o'clock in the morning. Or if it's, you know, stuck in customs in Los Angeles somewhere, it might be 10 o'clock at night. And all during the day, and normal hours, I have to say, are 8:30 till 5 o'clock. Very happy to talk to anybody between those hours. you can, there's a whole team of people you can talk to. I'm generally first port of call for any new people. But then if it's kind of something that's in progress, something that's in transit, then our operations team are all there, and that's headed by Antonia. And she's got a fantastic team underneath her as well.
It's just so nice to know that there's somebody there that you can trust and that's like listens and like is easy to talk to and understands your issues or problems, because that makes the process like worth it no end, you know.
It's also the two-way channel. Like when you're shipping stuff, like as a maker, you're not a professional shipper. You don't understand shipping. So to have someone you can back and forward with, and like you can, you know, say to us, or, and I know Zoe's found this a huge help whenever we've spoke to Zoe, who made the original introduction to yourself.
Yeah.
You know, having someone that's like, oh, have you thought about this as a maker? Have you thought about this? Like, these are all things you'll have to do. Yes, we can take care of them, but these are things you just need to know.
Yeah.
Kate and I are, we've just made our thing. We've never spoke to you guys before, right? We didn't even know about Ebus until our pal Zoe told us about it. We've made our thing and we want to ship it to an event in Taiwan.
Okay.
What does the process look like?
Okay, so you start off very simply. We always start off very simply with just like the basics. Where, it, you know, collection address. Where is the thing at the moment? What size is the thing, you know, what's it made out of, and where do you want it to go? So just the really, really simple stuff: where it is, how big is it, and where do you need it to go? And then you kind of get down into a bit more detail. So, you know, once you know how big it is and where it is, then you start thinking about, is this something that we are going to come and collect from you and pack it at our warehouse and then ship it from our warehouse? Or are you 500 miles away from us? Would it be better if we made you a crate or appropriate packaging, sent it to you for you to pack, and then we uplift direct from your property? And a lot of that depends on cost. So we're very happy to walk makers and artists through the cost options of us coming to collect, us just making a crate and sending it to you to pack. Are we going to air freight it? Are we going to sea freight it? Are we going to courier it? Are we going to direct deliver it? And all of these things have different time considerations and different cost considerations. So then we start to talk to the maker about, okay, you've got to get it to Thailand. How quickly does it need to get there? You know, is it going there because it's been sold to somebody and it's going to stay there, or is it going for an exhibition where it might get sold and it might come back, or is it just going for a display and it's definitely going to come back? And once you get into those kind of questions, then that leads to, okay, well, if it's scenario A, then this is the best way to do it. If it's scenario B, and yeah, and just carry on from there. And then once you've established kind of where it's coming from, how we're going to get it there, where it's going to, then you have to start talking about the paperwork, which is always the most appalling thing for people that are new to this process. because it all sounds so overwhelming and so daunting, and nobody's ever heard of a commercial invoice and people don't know what EORI numbers are and things like that. But, you know, once you've got it, once it's all done, it's a piece of cake the next time you want to do it.
Yeah.
Right, so that's all an early doors setup thing.
Yeah, a lot of it is. A lot of it is. It's kind of, it's like you said, it's explaining the process to people that have never done it before. Giving them as much information as they need, holding their hand through those initial steps so that they get comfortable with what you're doing for them. And then the next time they sell or they're going to an international exhibition or something like that, they're like, oh, okay, yeah, I remember how to do this. That's fine. I can just do this. That's my EORI number. That's the commercial invoice. You know, we give people templates that they can use again and again and again. And yeah, it's a whole part of the process. You walk them through it, you explain it, you spend the time and you invest the time in developing that relationship at the early stages, because that's the other thing as well. I mean, we're big believers in relationship. It's not commodity for us. It's about developing relationships with those artists like Zoe so that you get the repeat business, so that it works first time. It's as painless as it can be. That's not always painless, but as painless as it can be. And then, you know, they come back and they're confident to use you again and happy to use you again and recommend you to other people, which is all good in our world.
It's the best sort of word of mouth.
Word of mouth, still the best advertising, no matter what other options come out there. So tell me, at the start of your sort of explanation there, you mentioned, you know, the things that we would all think about, the size and the cost of said thing.
Yeah.
But you also mentioned what it's made of. Why is that important when shipping something?
Because there are all kinds of ways that we can pack things. It really is hugely dependent on what it's actually made of as to how you pack it. Paintings are easy. You know, for example, if it's just a canvas on stretchers, then that's absolutely fine, no problem at all. If it's something that's then framed and glazed, you need to think about, right, okay, how am I going to deal with this glass? Is the glass raised? Is there anything that kind of protrudes in front of the frame? All of that kind of business. If it's ceramics, then, you know, is it kind of like solid ceramics that's relatively robust, or am I looking at something that's, you know, a Peter Ting kind of ceramic that is incredibly fragile with lots of, you know, extended pieces that are just begging to be broken, that kind of thing. So it's really, really important to know exactly what it's made out of. If we've got pictures of it, then that's ideal, because we can think about how we're going to wrap it, whether we're going to float it in foam chips, if we're going to bubble it, if we're going to need some kind of T-frame to hold it together, if we need to bolt it to the bottom of a crate so it's kind of suspended in midair within that crate, kind of thing. So yeah, that's one of the things about having technicians on the art side that are creative as well and that can think outside the box, because they can come up with solutions that other people who just pack freight would not be able to see. They would not be able to envisage how we are going to put this sculptural object that, I mean, we had, this is a good example. We had a piece of taxidermy. It was a Victorian taxidermy. It was like some kind of bird, but it was enormous. It was in a glass case, like a meter high by 50 centimeters wide by 70 centimeters deep kind of thing. And the glass case was, you know, it could be lifted off, but the whole thing had to be freighted to America, and the chances of the damage to this glass case were just astronomically huge. But yeah. One of our technicians was like, right, okay, well, I don't know. I think we should do this. I think we should do this and do this and do this. And, you know, we packed it and crated it and shipped it off DHL, I think we used, to some museum in America. Got that absolutely fine, no problem whatsoever, perfectly intact.
That's brilliant.
So yeah, really important to consider what the piece is made out of as to how you're going to pack it.
Yeah, and like you say, that you don't have your own trains, you don't have your own planes, you don't have your own automobiles to get stuff there. But like, all of that's the same, whether you had your own trains, planes or automobiles, they all still travel. It's about how it travels. It's about what it travels in, isn't it?
Yeah, a train is a train, a plane is a plane, you know, a lorry is a lorry kind of thing. You have to provision for the unexpected, the unknown. When you're sending something air freight or courier and it's international, if it's going in a plane, then it's going to go in the hold of that plane along with whatever other freight is going in that plane. So your crate with your precious ceramic vase or what have you is going to be in a crate next to a crate of dog food or a crate of car parts or a crate of water bottles or whatever it happens to be. And you cannot legislate for that. So whatever you've packed into has got to be robust enough to be, and you don't like to think of things falling off of forklifts or, you know, being kicked around an airport, you know, hold area. But, you know, things happen. A crate is going to get put on top of your crate kind of thing. And if your crate's got ceramic in it and that's got a car engine in it, your crate's got to be big enough, tough enough to withstand that. So that's why the packing is really important.
Because you guys sent us a crate.
A couple
of months ago, and it's
a little example crate, didn't we?
Yeah, I'll show you. I'll show everybody. Look, it's here.
And by the way, it's a very good crate for moving podcast equipment around as well.
Yeah.
Oh, fantastic. Okay.
It's very sturdy, and there is nothing going to get broken inside that. That's for sure.
It's actually fantastic when you look at it as a crate, because so we've redeveloped our whole house. We stripped it back to brick and rebuilt it. And your crate's built the exact same way as we built the frame for our house. It's literally like timber framing a house, but it's for sending stuff across the world. So
yeah,
there you go. It's
nice.
Very sound.
I'm good. And
so tell me, you talked a little bit. Oh, sorry. On you go.
Go on, sorry. I was just going to say, there is always that that conflict between, you know, do I really need to put it in a crate? Can't I just pack it in some cardboard, or can't you just pack it in a triple wall cardboard box and send it in a triple wall cardboard box or a double wall cardboard box or something like that? And there is always a trade-off between cost and insurance, or peace of mind, I suppose. But yeah
there is.
And you know, these crates as well, I've got a number of questions about the crates and the way you do it. But the first one is, you mentioned there about suspending things in crates.
Yeah.
So that seems like the sort of creme de la creme for packaging something. You know, anyone thinking about suspending something, that's like the nuclear reactor in Batman The Dark Knight. It's just kind of suspended in a big crate, isn't it? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, it's kind of not really that sophisticated when we say kind of like floating. We don't actually mean floating. So what we would do is we would make a crate. We would line it with either foam or poly of different depths, depending on the piece that was going in it. The piece itself, we would then kind of like, on top of the foam lining, we'd then kind of layer foam chips, put the piece in on top of the foam chips, fill the void with the foam chips, and then put the lined kind of lid on it and kind of screw it all together. So we say it's floating, but it's floating in foam chips. Basically, it's like one of those ball pools that kids have at play.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, and kids are like, really good at chucking themselves at each other and naming people
exactly.
Seem to get hurt less than you would imagine.
Hurt each other, land on the balls, and it's kind of it's a double kind of layer of insulation and shock absorption and vibration mitigation and all of that kind of stuff. So it's that kind of suspended thing is really good for ceramics. I mean, we do properly suspended stuff for sculptural works that, you know, that cannot touch the sides, that, you know, that nothing needs to, that nothing can touch them kind of thing. And we do properly suspended things, as properly suspended works for that. And also lighting. We do quite a lot of glass work.
Yeah. Okay.
And some of the glass work we do has kind of hanging points, and is the hanging point that we bolt to the crate so that nothing and no other part of the crate touches that glass. And glass is, to a certain extent, or some of it, even more fragile than ceramics. But we do quite a lot of glass as well, which is nice.
Shipping's an art in itself, isn't it?
Oh, shipping, aye. Shipping anything that you've spent, and it's why we wanted to do this podcast, that you've spent so much time and money on. Because ultimately, it's irreplaceable. Mm-hmm. Like a lot of the makers that we are talking to, it is irreplaceable. Yes, they could make it again, but that takes time out of... No, and it also takes time out of what's been booked, and
there's nothing worse than doing something else again.
Yeah, if you're a one-man maker that's booked out for 18 months and you need to redo a one-month or two-month project again, or even a 1 or 2 day project again, like that has massive stressful implications on that.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah. So tell me, these crates as well, you know, that they're a substantial thing. Is it something that once the makers bought, paid, and say, for example, we've shipped it out to an exhibition, it's come back, is that then the maker's crate to reuse as required?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Once, yeah, the maker can do what they like with it kind of thing, it's theirs. I mean, we have makers that, yeah, that once they've had, they've, exhibition crates particularly, so if you've got somebody that's doing I don't know, an art fair or a ceramics fair in Hong Kong or America or what have you, we make them a fantastic crate to put all of their pieces in. Half of them sell, half of them don't. The half that don't need to be returned, they go back and, yeah, they have this fantastic crate to use in the future. Some of them just use it in their workshops. Others of them use it, you know, for the next 20 years to move their stuff from one exhibition to another or from their studio to galleries or what have you. But yeah, once it's theirs, once they've got it.
That's when it starts to make a lot of sense. Because I'm aware, like, yes, that's a more expensive option than just put it. I mean, it's a more reassured option than just putting it in a cardboard box. But if certainly for the events and galleries, if you can then get that back and reuse it at your own will, or have the customer return it. You know, if you're happy to pay it and have the customer return it and have that for your next piece, why would you not?
Well, exactly. Yeah, it does. It does. Particularly if, you know... Oh, go on, sorry.
No, sorry, please. Please go.
I have a tendency to just ramble on and go off at tangents. So, yeah, feel free to keep me on track.
No, please, on you go. You were saying something.
I can't even remember what I was going to say now.
No.
So you've got, obviously, they're wooden built crates. They're really sturdy wooden built crates. But am I right in thinking there's a lot of areas in the world that won't accept, I think Australia's pretty, I was going to say bad for it, but pretty strict about it. Like there's certain woods that won't be accepted and there's certain things that would end up with a lot of like lost artwork. It won't get through the border.
Yeah, basically anything these days. I mean, most countries in the world these days adhere to standards called ISPM 15, which are standards for basically the heat treatment of wood. And it goes into a lot of detail about, because our crates are made from heat treated timber, and then the sides are a certain thickness of ply, generally. All wood that goes through the exports or imports into the UK, into America, into Australia, into most places in Europe, have to adhere to these ISPM 15 standards. And if they don't, customs will just stop them. They'll just refuse them. I mean, we had a chap from South Africa, an artist from South Africa, who had made his own crate, lovingly made his own crate to put his artwork in, to ship it over to an exhibition in the UK. And his wood was not ISPM 15 certified. So it got to customs in the UK and they returned it straight away. He then had to unpack his artwork, take his lovely crate to, I think some kind of timber merchant or something like that locally to him, who then did the treating of it so that it, and then they could then stamp it with the ISPM 15 stamp, and then he repacked it and sent it all back. And it cost an absolute fortune, far more so than it would have done for him to just get a company to create it properly. So yeah, if you are making your own crates, and a lot of makers do, because obviously they're creative people, they can quite easily make a crate as well as they can make a ceramic or something like that. We're just really, really clear. ISPM 15, the regulations are really straightforward and they're on the government website. Just make sure if you're making your own crate, you adhere to those regulations and you'll be fine.
Because some people just don't know that at all.
You know, I don't know it.
I mean, I had a rough idea, you know, like about the different woods and making sure that if you send things overseas, that it has to be a certain type of wood. But like, as a, some people just don't know that. So it's good. It's good that, you know, you're aware of it, and you know.
But that's all stuff like you just take care of.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we don't do anything that's not ISPM 15 compliant, and it's the first question that we ask makers who say, okay, well, I'm gonna create this myself, or I've created it myself. The first question you ask is, okay, well, is the wood you used ISPM 15 compliant? I don't know. Okay, so go back to the timber merchant or whoever you bought the timber from and ask them. Because they should know, and if they do know and it is, then they should be either able to give you kind of like some kind of certificate or confirmation, or take your wood back to them and they'll just put a stamp on it or something like that. But one way or the other, you have to make sure that it's compliant with this, or else it won't even get out of the UK, let alone get into another country.
Maybe. How many makers at that point just say, Rhonda, go and just ship it for me? Because I would 100% just like, just you do it.
No, to be honest, I would say probably 90% of them, they want to go through the process. You know, they've got it in their heads that they're making it themselves. It's part of their process, their gift to whoever has purchased it. And I think once you've got that far along, you're pretty heavily invested in the whole business.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah,
that is true.
I guess custom paperwork's the next thing. Customs paperwork must be, it is a headache.
Yeah, let's talk about the rubbish bit right now.
Yeah.
Complying to government regulations.
Yeah, okay. So basically, if you use somebody like us, then we do all your customs paperwork for you. We do all the declarations. We do everything for you. The only thing that we ask from you is a commercial invoice. And we give all of our makers a template, all of our artists, clients, a template for a commercial invoice if they don't know what that is, if they've never done one before. And that basically gives us all of the details that we need to be able to do all of the customs paperwork for them, and also is their declaration that we are authorised to do all of that paperwork on their behalf, kind of thing. So it just covers absolutely everything. The most annoying things about the commercial invoice are things like HS codes, which are commodity codes. So every item in the world falls under some kind of categorization, and it's just a question of that maker determining what categorization their particular piece comes under. And if they need any advice or any help with that, then we're really happy to say, you know, what we think it should be. And it's really that HS classification is really important in so many ways. But primarily in terms of import duties and taxes on the other end. Because when you are sending things into a different country, whoever is receiving them has to pay import duties and taxes. But that's part of the agreement between the buyer and the seller who pays those fees. But those fees, whatever the level of fees are attributed to that particular item, are dependent on that HS classification. And for a lot of art, original art, ceramic, sculpture, that kind of thing, there are reduced rates, and that can make quite a significant difference in how much people have to pay in terms of duties and taxes. So it's really important to get that HS classification correct. And also to say on that commercial invoice, you know, this classification is for original artwork or whatever it happens to be. So reduced rates of import duty and import tax are payable. The other irritating thing about the commercial invoice is EORI numbers, and everybody just hates EORI numbers, but they're really simple, really, really easy. Basically, the rules are very straightforward. You know, if you are exporting anything from the UK now, you have to have an EORI number, and that's it, end of story. You don't have to be a business to have an EORI number. You don't have to be UK domiciled to have an EORI number. It is actually one of the more straightforward things to get. It's really not as intimidating as everybody thinks, oh my God, I'm going to have to apply for this EORI number. But really, it takes 10 minutes. It takes absolutely 10 minutes. It's free of charge. You've just got to follow the steps. And if you are at all worried about it or need help with it, then we'll just run through it with you. I mean, we've done it for countless people. You know, you're on the phone with someone, you're following through the process as they're, you know, screen sharing, filling in the forms. You need to put this, you need to put that, you need to put the other. It's really, really easy, and very, very quick and free. And once you've got your EORI number, you're done. It's a one-off. That's it. You just use it again and again and again. You never have to go through the process again, and it's absolutely fine. Once you have looked up your HS codes, and there are a couple of really good websites out there to help people with, you know, classification, what code they should particularly use, then commercial invoices are a breeze. First time you've done one, pain. Second time you do it, no problem, done this before, know exactly what to do. Thank you very much.
How much of your work at the minute is talking people through the steps and demystifying shipping?
Quite a lot. For every new client that comes on board, and even for some clients that have been with us for a long, long time, customs rules change all the time. You know, Brexit was not our friend.
No.
It wasn't anyone's friend. I'm still waiting for someone to tell us it was their friend.
Yeah, it really was not our friend. So, yeah, a lot of what we do is hand-holding. A lot of what we do is explanation and this, that and the other. But then that's part of the service we offer. I think we've said to you before, we are not the cheapest provider out there. We're never going to be the cheapest provider out there. But we provide a proper, full-on quality service. So anyone that works with us knows that at any time they can just phone us up and ask a question. Doesn't have to be related to a specific shipment that they're doing. If they just need some advice and guidance, then that's what we're here for. It's about the relationship, not the commodity.
Yeah, it seems very value-driven what you're doing. You know, I've noticed a lot of people that have mentioned you have either been, you know, shipping a couple of things a year or shipping very big, expensive stuff a year. You seem to be able to fit into all of the product bands. You know, it'd be very easy for someone to be listening to this and thinking, yeah, that's all well and good, but I'm not shipping £10,000 artwork every day. How does it differ for smaller customers that are maybe shipping £20-30 mugs versus, you know, multi-£1,000 stone carvings?
Well, the process is the same. I mean, a client is a client. What they need shipped is what they need shipped. The process we go through with everybody is the same, really. It doesn't, I mean, we, yeah, really, because it's very difficult to, our philosophy is always that we treat everybody the same regardless of what they're shipping, because just because you're shipping X today doesn't mean that in 2 years' time or 5 years' time you might not be shipping Y. So, you know, you're shipping 20 mugs today, it might be 20,000 mugs in 3 years' time or something like that. So if we treat everybody the same and offer everybody the same level of service, or the level of service that they need, because some people want more service than others, and it just is what it is. Some people need more handholding. Other people are very comfortable to just, yep, you can do that, thank you very much, don't want to hear about it till it's there.
Yeah, there doesn't seem to be a huge amount of people that think that way from the companies we've interacted. But you're right, you know, it may not make a lot of sense on paper for you at the single point of customer interaction, but that lifetime value for the customer is really what makes the difference for you, isn't it?
Yeah, for us it is. It's just, you know, we like to, we have clients that we've had for, you know, 10 years kind of thing, and they started off just doing, like you said, like we might ship one piece for them in the first year kind of thing, a couple of pieces second year, and it just builds. And it, you know, even if it never gets to more than a couple of pieces a year, it's still business is business, you know, it's still all good. They need to have somebody reliable that they know will take care of their work and that will give them time and consideration, even though it is only two pieces they're shipping a year. And for us, it's bread and butter. You know, it's it might not be the massive art event or the huge public sculpture or, you know, the Picasso that we're picking up from Sotheby's or something like that. But work is work, and we are happy.
Yeah, happy to help. Yeah.
That's good. So tell me, there's probably a lot of people thinking, you know, we're talking building custom ships, custom crates to ship. We're talking customs paperwork. We're talking... It feels like an expensive process by comparison to chucking it in a box and going. How expensive is it to ship something? You know, have you got an example price there?
I did work one out based on that crate that, I mean, the short answer is how long's a piece of string, really? Because it depends so much on the size of the crate that's actually going, the weight of the crate that's actually going, because shipping is charged basically on volume and volumetric rate weight. So it's, your pricing is based on, and this gets a bit techy, is based on the higher of either the actual weight of your piece in the crate all packed and ready to go, or more generally the volumetric weight, which is worked out on the size of the crate. And whichever is the greater is what you will get charged, obviously, by whichever freighter that is taking your work. So that's one of the other reasons why we employ people that are creative and think outside the box, because we don't want massive shipping crates for, we're not, you know, you need to get something from Amazon and it turns up in the most, it's like a battery pack and it turns up in the most,
yeah, when you get a Q-tip in a 1 meter square box. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. We don't do that. We have our people think creatively about how to pack well, but how to pack with the kind of like the most efficient size crate for a particular project. I mean, I think the crate that we sent you was 50 centimeters, like half a meter by 30 by 30 centimeters by 30 centimeters.
I would say that's pretty accurate looking at it, yeah.
And a crate that size with a 25 mil foam lining, I think would be £117.
It's not bad when you think about, you know, just
Show it off again.
Yeah. To show it off again, yeah. When you think about what can fit in that size crate.
Yeah, it's a pretty decent size if you're sending small ceramics and stuff like that. And then just in terms of shipping costs, I think I gave you an example. If we were to ship that crate to New York, you'd be looking, I don't know, 230 quid, something like that. If you were to ship that crate to Berlin, it would only be slightly cheaper, about like 220 quid, something like that. Because again, it's all about the volumetric, not necessarily how far it's going. I mean, if we're going to Australia, then it might be slightly different because there is, you know, there's a big difference between Australia and America. But yeah, it's, I think the point is it's not as cost prohibitive as people might initially think it is. They might be thinking, you know, packing crates, oh my God, you know, my piece is only worth, I've only sold it for £500. You know, it's going to cost me hundreds to get that packed in a crate and shipped off. It's always worth the question. It's always worth asking the question. And we're always happy to, for anybody to inquire and us to give them an estimate of how much it would be to collect, pack, crate, ship. And then you have frame of reference for the future as well. You know, you might not, you know, by no stretch of the imagination does everybody we quote always say yes. A lot of people say, actually, no, that's too expensive for my client or blah, blah, blah. And we do our best to find alternative options if things are cost prohibitive. But I think for a lot of people, they're put off by the thought of it when they really shouldn't be, because it's not, for some stuff particularly, it's not as expensive as you would think it is, particularly when you take into account everything else that we do.
Well, this is it, and it's kind of why I wanted to speak to you, because there's certainly with shipping, there's just a bit of demystification to do. Like, £235 that you said there for the shipping, like, you're going to pay that regardless if it's DPD or whatever. Like, the shipping is the shipping.
Yeah.
And the £117 you quoted for that crate, especially if you're getting that crate back and you do 3-4 exhibitions a year, you know, it's 35, 25 quid per time you go, to know that your stuff's not...
And exactly.
Also remember, every time you ship something, that's another chance of it getting broken.
Yeah.
Every time it lies about the workshop unpackaged, it's another chance to get broken. They're all...
Yeah.
Yes, it seems like a lot of money on the front of it. Well, actually, does it seem like a lot of money? I'm not convinced it does. But the backside of it is it's a huge amount of effort and money if you break it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. And a lot of our makers, like we said before, do use them for things like workshop storage and stuff like that, of pieces that are ready to go, or, you know, pieces that are, you know, just fired out of the kiln or just carved or what have you. They're somewhere safe, protected for wherever they're going to head off.
I mean,
next.
Shipping is expensive no matter where you go.
Regardless.
I mean, even shipping our magazine around the world, it's expensive, and it's a small thing.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it goes on a cardboard slide.
I know, it's just mental. But like, if you're shipping something really expensive and it's in a box, I mean, and the value that you provide, I think, you know, it's
a value
good.
Proposition at
it
that
is.
Point, isn't it? It's
it really
value rather than cost.
That is exactly what it is, a value proposition. I really like that phrase because it is really descriptive of what, because when, you know, you were talking about makers' time earlier, and when you think about the time that if you are shipping something yourself, the time it takes you to make the crate, the time it takes you to do the paperwork, the time it takes you to understand the paperwork, to go to wherever you need to go to drop it off, to do all of the follow-up and the chasing and the payment of the fees and all of the other sundry, you know, what if you get stuck in customs, what the heck do you do then, kind of thing. There is, yeah, the time adds up, the stress adds up, and there is a great deal to be said for just being able to offload that onto somebody else to say, okay, well, now it's your proposition, you deal with it. and I want to know when it's arrived. Thank you very much. Nothing.
That's exactly it. You know, with all the makers, and it's the reason that Kate and I wanted to start talking to service providers as well that are directly related to the makers. Every maker we speak to, the common theme is I wear too many hats.
Yeah.
You know, we spoke to Nicole Bedard and brand photography, and we spoke to Sarah about pricing and now yourself about shipping. And we want to continue this theme of also speaking to makers, but speaking to service providers, because yes, you're wearing too many hats. Fact.
Yep.
Give somebody else one of those hats, especially if they're already set up to do it, because they're going to do it much more efficiently than you are, is the reality.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's the same in every industry. It's like you have, you know, like you were saying with your house, I'm sure there are certain parts of your house that you would not, maybe you wouldn't have tackled the roof yourself, kind of thing. You've got somebody in to do the roof. Shipping's exactly the same. Maybe you can do the plumbing and the electrics, but not the roof. So maybe a maker can make a crate and crate it all and be happy with that, and then just want somebody else to do the shipping and everything else. So it's all about picking and choosing. And the thing with us is that we're happy to do as many steps as the particular maker wants us to do. We can do everything from, I've just made this, take it away, deal with it, thank you very much, and it ends up where it ends up. Or, you know, as many parts of that along the way as the particular maker wants us to do. So it's not an all or nothing. It's an array from which you can pick and choose.
Okay, I didn't understand that about you guys. I thought it was like, we'll deal with it all or nothing. So you will deal with certain aspects if the maker wants that and quote for just that, or you will deal with all of it if the maker wants that?
Yeah, as much or as little as... I mean, we are a full-service kind of organisation, so we can do everything from end to end. But we are also very, very happy to be accommodating and flexible and just do bits and pieces. For example, Zoe actually is a good example. So our kind of normal course of business is we will pick up from the maker, we'll bring it back to our workshop and, you know, warehouse kind of thing. We will remeasure because we do like to remeasure, because sometimes makers do not give us the correct dimensions, so we like to remeasure. Then we make the crate for whatever it happens to be, then we'll do the paperwork, then we'll do the shipping and blah 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 blah. But with Zoe, because she lives quite a distance from us, it's actually quite cost ineffective for us to collect from her. But she's, you know, she's a carver, and she is very precise in what she does, and so we know when we get measurements from Zoe that they are perfectly accurate measurements. So we make a crate specific to her measurements, ship the crate to her, she does the packing. Other people, they deliver to our warehouse. They would prefer to drive and deliver it to us and kind of hand it over than for us to collect from them. Other people like to create themselves, kind of thing, and make the crate themselves, and we just do the paperwork and the shipping. So yeah, it's kind of, you know, whatever service, whatever level of service suits that particular maker, then that's what we're happy to do.
So tell me, you mentioned there where people deliver. Where exactly is your warehouse workshop for dropping off for people listening?
So we are based in Haywards Heath, which is between kind of Gatwick Airport and Brighton in the south of England. Yeah.
And what, so you've mentioned there, you know, precision and measurements. What advice can you give to makers listening to this that want to measure it, that maybe up our way in Glasgow, that need you just to send the crate? Like, how do we best communicate to you what our requirements are?
It's just really simple. Just drop me an email that says, this is a picture of what I've made. these are the maximum dimensions. Height, width, depth is all I really need, or height, diameter if it's spherical or something like that. But the maximum dimensions of a particular piece, and a picture of it so that we can determine if there's any, you know, if there's any things that we need to be more appropriately conscious of fragility on, or that kind of thing.
Yeah. And we'll put your email and get the contact email off you to put in the show notes as well, for people to do that, to make it as easy as possible. I know we've got a landing page, a We Are Makers X eBus landing page, so we can direct people to that as well. How many units do you think you're shipping for Makers and Arts a year?
Oh my goodness. I've got absolutely no idea. Really, absolutely no idea. I mean, we do such a lot of bulk stuff as well for art events, where we are looking after, I don't know, 30 artists that are showing at an art event in Copenhagen or something like that, and we're taking all of their work.
A lot.
God. A lot. I mean, we ship every day. A lot. I mean, we ship every day. It might be two items, one item. It might be 20 items. You know, we, DHL and other couriers are available, come to collect from our place on a daily basis. And we freight. Air freight is a different thing, where we have to deliver direct to the airport, normally bigger items, more high value items, things where we want more control over the entire end-to-end process. We send air freight rather than courier. We're sending air freight every day. Sea freight we don't do so much, because it takes too long. Generally, people want their things now. Sometimes when we're doing exhibitions, though, we might send to, we're doing one at the moment, we're sending, kind of numerous crates containing exhibition materials, exhibition objet. I don't even know what they are. They look like they're made out of wood and stone. But anyway, they're going off to America. We're air freighting them out there, because of the control and all of that kind of stuff, and because it's big, there's a lot. But they're going to come back, see, because it doesn't matter.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Okay, so you can be flexible and cost efficient in that manner. That makes a lot of sense. You know, it's interesting you say you're shipping so much, because all the conversations allude to like a smaller operation, which I know it's not a big operation, you know, it's not some gigantor company. But you're obviously still doing the volume, which with comes experience, with which comes X, Y, Z and all those things. It's quite a lot. Mm-hmm. Like, it's quite a lot.
Yeah, it is quite a lot. I mean, we do have, we have a storage facility as well. We have a storage offering. So we have a lot of clients that store paintings and ceramics and things like that with us. And a lot of them are dealers, so we have a lot of kind of in and out for dealers, showing things, sending it to a gallery, bringing it back, sending it to an exhibition, bringing it back.
So is that another offering that you guys have? Like, if someone's got a bunch of stuff that they know is going to exhibition after exhibition, rather than them keep it in their own space and take up their own making space, you actually store it as well and ship it straight out from there?
Yep, we do. We have kind of an online portal where we kind of log every single item that comes into our warehouse that belongs to that particular dealer, gallery, maker, artist, whoever it happens to be. And then they can just log on to that portal and say, right, okay, this, and this. I want them all bundled up, and they need to go to this exhibition, or this one piece needs to go here, or this, that, or the other. And yeah, we offer that as a storage solution provider.
That's a phenomenal idea. I had no idea you guys done that. Because I had no idea.
Really?
No idea, because we know so many makers that are tripping over stuff in their studios. And oftentimes it's, oh, this just came back from there and it goes out to there in 2 months' time, so I'm just tripping over it for 2 months in between.
Yeah. Yeah, we do a lot of that. It kind of developed from the events and exhibition side of the business, where we support clients I was telling you earlier who take part in events all over the world. So it started off with stand materials, really, and promotional materials, promotional items that they have on their stands, storing all of that for them. And then as the art business developed, we were like, well, we do this with events, we do it with art. And then we just started strong. We've got racks and racks and racks of paintings and boxes of ceramic. Yeah. Well, if you're ever down this way, come visit our warehouse.
Yeah, we will.
I think we will. It'd also be good to get, you know, a bunch of stuff while we're down there and put that out to the makers' world and show what you guys have to offer.
Yeah. Hopefully sooner than later, because we keep meaning to go down south.
Yeah. And we keep going to more exotic places instead that are warmer.
Yeah.
So, Rhonda, that's been fantastic. Is there anything you want to cover while we're here? We tried to cover everything and sort of demystify shipping for the listeners, and obviously everyone now knows to get in contact with yourself, Rhonda Dearsley at Ebis. And again, we'll put that in the show notes. But is there anything you think's worthwhile covering for people that we've not managed to cover yet?
I think maybe licenses. Licenses is quite a good one. It comes under paperwork, but it's slightly different, because there are a lot of makers out there that make not out of non-traditional things. For example, the makers in wood, there are a lot of export licenses that are required for, and import licenses for different countries that are made out of wood, that are not kind of standard. There's also a lot of kind of flora and fauna. You know, we have one artist that makes out of ceramic, that makes out of concrete rather, that has live moss growing on it, and that's always a challenge getting that into different countries. Paperwork, licenses. I don't know really. I mean, we have so much experience in so many different areas. We help makers individually, artists individually. We help galleries. We help dealers. We support big art events. Things like Collect, you know, we've been the logistics partner for Collect for years. We support Start Art Fair, we support The Other Art Fair. We have a whole range of experience. I think the only thing that I would say is that don't be put off. Don't think that using a shipping company is going to be too expensive, because you're new or your things are not, you know, massively expensive or anything like that. It's always worth a conversation, and we're always happy to have the conversation. Even as I said, if you don't end up using us, at least if we can help you sort your paperwork side of things out, then at some point in the future, you'll remember that we helped you with X, Y, and Z and come back to us, hopefully, with a quote for something else. You know, it's a relationship. Don't be scared to ask us. You don't have to say yes just because we've given you a quote kind of thing. You can say, actually, no, it's too expensive, I'm going to do it differently this time. But thank you very much for your help. I think I've probably covered everything, but if anyone's got any...
Yeah, I think so.
It's great to know that service is out there, though, isn't it? Like, there's so many unknowns when you're a maker.
Yeah.
There's so many unknowns when you start out as a maker. Just to know that that's a whole side of it that can just be demystified through a phone call.
Yeah, yeah.
Is really important. Mm-hmm. And now we know storage can be demystified through a phone call too.
It's great.
Which is awesome. Rhonda, I've thoroughly enjoyed this.
Yeah,
I don't
too.
Think it'll be... Let me just check. We did get a bunch of questions, but I think we've covered them all.
Yeah.
A lot of them were, you know, licensing, paperwork, all that jazz. And I think in answer to all of them, it's just get on the phone to you. Because there'll be so many different kinds of licenses and so many different kinds of paperwork. We can't sit here for 10 hours talking about all the different ones. So, but yeah.
Cool. Well, I hope it's helped. No, I'm not just...
No, it's been fantastic, and it really has demystified it. Like, as I say, I don't want to overuse the term, but it's just another thing that people don't have to think about.
Yeah, it's another option for them.
Yeah.
Exactly. And it really is, it's straightforward if you know what you're doing, and we know what we're doing. We've been doing it for a lot of time, and we've come across every conceivable scenario, so whatever anyone has to do or wherever they have to go, the chances are we've done it before, or shipped there before. And like I said, it's always worth a conversation. We're always open to the conversation, so start a conversation.
Good.
Rhonda, thanks so much for your time.
Yeah.
I really appreciate it. I really look forward to getting this podcast out in the next week or so.
Yeah.
And as I say, there's been a lot of people asking about it. So let's hope that it answers a lot of questions. If anyone listening to it doesn't answer any of the questions, Rhonda Dearsley, email's in the show notes, website's in the show notes. Get on over and find out more about it.
Yeah.
Happy to help. Thank you very much for having me.
Wicked. Thanks, Rhonda. Cheers, pal.
Have a really good day.
Have a good day. Bye.
Bye-bye.